The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So welcome everybody. My name is Dave Meesing. I'm chairing this session. Andrew will join us, I think, momentarily. He's coming back from a wedding. I'm with Viewpoint Magazine, and we're happy to sponsor this panel on rethinking class decomposition and organizational fragmentation. We have Jason Reed and Rodrigo Nunez with us to give papers, and then Bua will respond at the end. So I'll turn it to Jason first, and then Rodrigo can follow, and then we'll do the discussion.
Okay, I should be going around a little handout, which is an aphorism from Horkheimer's Dawn and Decline that I'm going to talk about kind of as the initial impetus. So I'm not sure if I'm going to encompass, as so often the case, everything in my title. But I think the place where I'm trying to connect with a lot of the themes in this conference, especially around surplus populations, and trying to name and theorize this current conjuncture, one phrase that I've been drawn to, or one naming I've been drawn to, is this phrase negative solidarity, which I actually picked up from a blog somewhere, and I would love to one day meet the author of that blog. And negative solidarity is used to describe this sort of, as the author put it, this aggressive sense of injustice. That is usually aimed in a strictly downward manner, in the sense that negative solidarity looks at whatever few gains that workers might have, such as health benefits, retirement, or teachers. Teachers are often the objects of negative solidarity with their unions, benefits, and their cushy summers off, and looks at it instead of sort of advocating for the extension of these conditions to other workers. It asks the question, you know, why do they have it, why do I don't? So it's this kind of downward race. And one of the things I'm especially interested in is, in trying to think through, is the way that work itself has functioned as an aspect of this negative solidarity, a certain kind of hatred of work that doesn't lead to a large-scale social organization around work and the refusal of work, but instead is tied to this idea that somewhere, somehow, there are people out there who aren't working and should be working. Whereas the bumper sticker, which I regularly see, says, "Keep working, millions of welfare depend on it." The sense of kind of a resentment aimed towards this fictitious idea of someone who's benefiting when you were not. And it was around this that drew me. This is the passage I want to talk about briefly to kind of start things, is this aphorism from Dawn and Decline by Max Horkheimer, which is a book that is, in translation at least, completely out of print, which is kind of unfortunate. Because Horkheimer, in some sense, Horkheimer shows himself in some of the early ones, because it's split between the pre-war and post-war sections of aphorisms. In some of the early ones, he shows himself to be the much more militant Marxist version of a kind of Frankfurt school that's since been eclipsed. And many of his little aphorisms deal with work, and especially what I would call the intersection of capital and its production of subjectivity, or its creation and transformation of the most basic aspects of character, desire, habits, and so on. And so it's very unfortunate that it's put out print. It's also unfortunate, and maybe part of the reason why I wanted to talk about an aphorism is I think, you know, in philosophy we've too readily surrendered the aphorism form to Nietzsche, and they get to have all the fun with it, and the sort of aphorisms of the kind that Horkheimer and even Adorno too offer a way to think through not just aphoristically around, you know, sort of the grandiose themes of Nietzsche, but around issues like class and its transformation. So this is the aphorism is called, this is the thing in its entirety. Whoever doesn't work shouldn't eat. This biblical pronouncement is a popular maxim. It should say everyone should eat and work as little as possible. But even that is much too general. To make work the most important human activity is an aesthetic ideology. How harmonious society looks when everyone works, irrespective of differences in rank and wealth, because the socialists retain this general concept, they become the instrument of a capitalist propaganda. Actually, the work of a cartel director, the small entrepreneur, and the unskilled worker are just as different from each other as power differs from worry and hunger. The proletarians demand that work be reduced. This does not mean that in a future, better society, a person should be prevented from being active as he pleases. Instead, the goal is to rationalize the activities of life in society requires and distribute them evenly. Compulsion, not freedom, suffering, not pleasure, are to be curbed. In a rational society, the concept of work changes. But today, those who don't work shouldn't eat is secretly no longer meant to define the future but the present. The sentence transfigures the existing order. It justifies the capitalist. He works. But it damns the poorest, for they don't. Everywhere, the bourgeoisie managed to reconcile an originally revolutionary thought of his own making, and which the socialists retain as a general maxim, with reactionary morality of the ruling class. But the phrase envisages a future society, and what should be inferred from it now is not the sanctification of work, but the struggle against its present form. And so a couple of things coming from that. One this is a theme that actually showed up in several aphorisms, the sense that there's almost a homonym around the question of work, that we shouldn't too readily lump together under some kind of anthropology all sorts of diverse activities that count as work. Doing so effaces the fact that, as the last sentence of the first paragraph says, different types of work differ from each other as much as power differs from worry and hunger. And elsewhere in his aphorisms, Horkheimer takes up the claim of the capitalist who says, you know, I love to work, I don't understand my workers. And this, you know, the claim underwritten by someone for whom work is showing up in an office and sort of managing and manipulating others versus someone whose work is burdened with physical toil and exhaustion, and that sort of non-comprehension forgets that under the category of work are classified many diverse activities. So the first thing is this sense of there are differences internal to this question of work, but it's really the last part that really struck me. The sense that the biblical saying, those who didn't work, who don't work, shouldn't eat, has been absolutely transfigured to no longer become a revolutionary claim against capital, become a sort of justification. And you know, you see this throughout all the various right-wing ideologies in their accusations against immigrants, against various whatever population is usually branded with not working or not working sufficiently. And in this place, you get this sort of figure of the capitalist as worker. And what interests me there, in sort of thinking about these different senses, one gets this sense of work being sort of maintained now as a claim of some kind of moral standing, of a kind of ethos. And I was thinking through, trying to work through this kind of aphorism and think multiple ways of kind of conceptualizing it. Because on one hand, we can read this along the lines of, very much in lines of a kind of dialectic of enlightenment, where here we have something that once was revolutionary and now is turned in its instrumentation to be repressive. But I was thinking more along the ways in which the split between work understood as an ethical demand and imperative, and work understood as an economic activity, shows up throughout the history of philosophy. I mean, the most striking place, and I'm not going to go too long into this because it's a long, long topic, is of the famous sections in Hegel's Philosophy of Right, where he discusses the problem of the rabble, right? And he says in the philosophy, this is the rabble, these are people who have been in some sense, modernized out of jobs because the rise of productionist development has left them with no proper place anymore. And as Hegel says in the Philosophy of Right, and he kind of outlines, this is why Frank Rood and others have written about this, a kind of rift that is at the core of sort of Western capitalist societies, and that is, on the one hand, we could give these people, society's wealthy enough, we could give these people the means to survive, without work. But in doing so, we would in some sense deny them the place of respect and belonging that work gives them, or we could give them work, but that would in some sense violate the very principle of civil society, which is based on free property and competition. And of course, one thing that's interesting about Hegel's discussion of this kind of rift is that is exactly what borne out. I mean, Robert Castell talks about this, even Foucault talks about this in the book on madness, that in some sense there's always this divide up until the present around what to do with the rabble. Either you give them stuff, in which case there's this anxiety about what work is supposed to do and shape and form and discipline them, or you give them work, in which case you violated the basic principle of some kind of free competition amongst workers. And of course, Hegel has a solution, which is a non-solution. He's like, colonies. But of course, then he even admits that you're going to run out of, the earth is round, you're going to run out of place to colonize, and so on. But of course, what interests me is less is prescriptive dimension, but the way in which Hegel can be read as kind of figuring a kind of dialectic around work, a split between the ethical disciplinary function of work and its economic function, which are, in some sense, never entirely coincide, but must necessarily coincide for capital to function. And the whole history of capital is a history of trying to reconcile those two sides. Or we can think of this as a kind of precursor to what Etienne Balibar calls a dialectic of the other scene, in which the other scene here is that work is simultaneously an activity that produces the necessary conditions for survival and an activity that produces a kind of mode of subjection, of discipline, and so on. And I think it's useful to think in those terms because we want to think of these two different scenes around work. Work being both economic and disciplinary, then we also have to think about the way in which both those scenes, kind of one divides into two, or themselves split. And this is what I think Horkheimer is getting at in his passage, that the economy or capital itself or capitalist work never really has a univocal or simplistic meaning, right? And that the economic can be figured as both a side of antagonism, of exploitation, but it also can be figured as a site of entrepreneurial activity and so on. I mean, the great line that actually Balibar has about this, kind of summing up in one sentence sort of the transformations around the figuration of work in contemporary capitalism, in which he says, nowadays the worker is branded as an investor in human capital, and the capitalists themselves are seen as workers, as entrepreneurs. And this kind of almost inverted world of the worker becomes someone who is increasingly thought to see themselves as a capitalist, as an investor in their own human capital, which they can either utilize or squander, and the worker is seen the capitalist is seen as a worker, as an entrepreneur, or as, and Balibar doesn't even go this far, but, in the modern American usage, the ultimate inversion is that the capitalist becomes the job creator, right? The one who is no longer dependent upon work, but miraculates work out of their own sort of wealth and generosity. And of course, I think to think through these transformations and refigurings, one has to think about how they reflect both what is happening at the level of ideology, obviously. I mean, someone deserves an ideological prize for coining the phrase job creator. I mean, if there was a contest, like awards given for ideological interventions, one should be given for that. But also, at the same time, we have to think about the way in which transformations in the nature of work itself are also the preconditions for these transformations of these the way these different scenes play themselves out. Because, you know, Balibar's notion of the other scene is a sense that that the economy is always having effects on the level of the social imaginary, and the social imaginary is always having effects on the level of the economy. There's always this kind of displacement from one to the other. So when we think about the social imaginary, the job creator, we have to think about the way in which, in dealing with a contemporary situation of capital, at least in the U.S., you have this increasing tendency for people to have the sense that the jobs they do, jobs in services and so on, strike them, people who are doing them, as kind of unnecessary, as if these jobs shouldn't exist, right? As if they only exist based on the generosity of an employer rather than fulfilling some kind of social need. So the kind of a different level of a kind of alienation. I mean, this is what David Graeber very crudely tried to get at with this notion of bullshit jobs. But the sense of this strong sense that people go to work and feel like under the best of circumstances, their work shouldn't even exist. So I think, and trying to chart through this, of course, I'm trying to map out both the dominant ideology and its material conditions and effects, but I'm also trying to see in this moment what are the positive dimensions. And I think the positive dimension, if one wanted to be optimistic, is whereas in its long history, you know, anti-workism has been kind of at the fringes of Marxist and communist thought and practice, and often associated with, like, you know, weird ideas about the right to be lazy and so on. But now, at this moment where if the capitalists want to claim themselves and position themselves as workers or the generators of work, there's this prospect where anti-workerism could not just be at the fringes of contemporary Marxist politics, but it seems like it must necessarily move to the center, right? That it must necessarily, I mean, here I'm just picking up on ideas that have been put out by other thinkers in this tradition, that there's no longer anything to be extracted from the value of work. And it seems to be that the task of contemporary politics around work is how to transform what I would consider a kind of right anti-workism, right? This constant, this sort of like strangely Puritan, like I'm working, I hate it, it's terrible, but at least I'm working, and there are others who do not work, and I'm going to mobilize against them out of this strange combination of both resentment and some strange sense of a resentment tinged with a kind of dignity. So that's what I would consider to be sort of right anti-workism. And the need to transform that right anti-workism into a more communist anti-workism, in which the question of work is tied not to simply a constant mobilization against those who supposedly do not work, but against the form of work itself as a basis of social existence. And especially, it seems to me that the real question, the question I'm trying to work through right now, is precisely the why it is, and this is something picked up on in the various writers of anti-work now, Kathy Weeks, Peter Fleming, etc. Everyone hinges upon the same paradox, that at the exact moment when the possibility and in some way the reality of less work is out there, the notion of work has become all the more sort of sacralized and taken to be a kind of value at the exact moment when its material conditions make possible its overcoming. And in some ways, its overcoming is being sort of fostered on people who are being radically, you know, being excluded from work. And it's precisely trying to think through that that ethical valuation in the face of its material diminution that this notion of this constant shifting semantics of work passing in between this ethical register, this political register, and this economic register seems to be useful. And I think the kernel to extract from that is to see the anti-work at the core of these rather reactionary political movements that are all about, you know, foistering work on those who supposedly do not sow enough. So, thank you.
So, thank you, everyone, for coming. You're going to notice that the two papers work at very different levels, so I don't envy Bua's task of trying to bring the two together, but I think there's an interesting conversation to be established there. And I apologize, I'm mostly going to read because that's the only effective way of timing myself. At the turn of the century, it was widely believed that the changing nature of capitalism, the spread of information technology, and the increasingly networked nature of social and political life had superseded the terms in which the question of organization had traditionally been put. Parties, vanguards, leaders, and other such things were thought to have become relics of a past that ultimately had more failures than victories to show for itself. Subsequent political experiences, not least the path leading from the struggles of 2011 to the global right-wing turn of 2016, have seemed to suggest that the news of all those demises may have been exaggerated, more a wishful thinking-laced attempt to do away with the answers provided by the tradition than a serious reckoning with the questions that these purported to answer. So what I'm going to do in this presentation is to take the issue of leadership as an example of one such question that cannot be easily done away with. But I plan to do so as an immanent critique that aims to pose the question again, rather than, as is often the case, a mere plea for a return to the certainties of the past. So in case you worried that the conclusion is going to be, and this is why we need the party, don't worry. I start by turning Hart and Negri's concept of the multitude, perhaps the ultimate epitome of those heady days at the turn of the century, against itself in order to show that networks do not eliminate, but rather presuppose leadership. This leads in turn to a redefinition of leadership in network terms that I hope to show cuts transversally across debates opposing informal and formal organization, horizontality and verticality, etc. And finally, I bring this reconceptualization of leadership to bear on current debates on populism. Actually, I doubt there'll be the time to do that, but we can pick up on that in the discussion. Let's begin then. In Multitude, Hart and Negri proposed the brain as a model for how the multitude can arrive at a decision. Yet when Hart and Negri write that, I quote, "From the perspective of neurobiologists, the one never decides," we must be careful to avoid confusion. It is true that there is no one that makes decisions in the brain, if by that we understand that there is no entity outside the brain, a mind or a soul, that controls brain functions so as to determine neural networks to work in this or that way, nor is there inside it a permanent center of control. That, however, does not entail that cerebral activity involves the simultaneous, equal, or consensual action of all brain cells as if it were an undivided soul or a general assembly deciding by consensus. So I'm thinking of various models of brain, of how the brain works, such as Varela's model of resonant cell assemblies. On the contrary, the brain organizes itself by means of the discontinuous, distributed activity of different centers of action formed by different neural networks which succeed each other at different times in the task of coordinating the actions of one another. The brain, in short, is neither a deliberative democracy, it does not collectively deliberate as such, nor is it a subject, and while it is certainly possible and correct to describe the process of innovation and imitation, rupture and mutual capture that characterizes cerebral activity as self-organized, this is to position oneself outside it, to take an external or transcended perspective on the brain. What would it be like to be a brain? It is, as we have seen, like nothing at all, as the brain is not a subject, but seen from the inside, as it were, from the perspective of brain cells or neural networks, the same process that appears from the outside as self-organization appears instead as the action of some individuals on others, or groups of individuals on others. In the same way, each finite individual who participates in the multitude does not experiment whatever action takes place as pertaining to the totality as such, i.e. as belonging to the multitude, but as the action of some finite individuals, singular or collective, on some others. Self-organization then does not name the perfect reciprocity or leveling of an absolute horizontality, but the very movement through which some parts act on others, action on the actions of others, as per the late Foucault's cybernetic definition of power. In other words, what we call self-organization is no more than the effect of the superposition and crisscrossing of various hetero-organizations, or if we want to speak as Spinozists, proximate causes, the precarious, unstable movement through which elements within a whole act on one another so as to produce effects of greater or lesser amplitude on or across that whole. So self-organization operates metonymically in a pars pro toto sense, the parts standing for the whole, as the process through which parts enacting upon each other act upon or on behalf of the whole, but it's never an action of the whole as such, except metonymically in a totum pro parte sense, i.e. the whole standing for the parts. So as in we saw in the brain example, by brain activity we mean the activity of neural networks. A quick parenthesis on that, slightly more abstract parenthesis, is that I think we could actually extract two general theoretical points from this. To the extent that calling a system self-organized supposes isolating it in some way from others, and to the extent that any such isolation is arbitrary to some degree, given that every system is part of at least one other system, or which amounts to the same, that the only system that could be non-arbitrarily isolated is the entire universe, we would be justified in concluding that, as Heinz von Förster put it in his opening address to the First International Conference on Self-Organization in 1959, properly speaking, there are no such things as self-organizing systems. So the first general point here would be that to identify a system as self-organized involves ignoring, to some extent, the higher order systems in which it is embedded. The second conclusion would be, in turn, that identifying a system as self-organized also involves ignoring the lower order systems embedded in it. So in the example above, we look at the brain as a whole and erase the individuality of the brain cells or neural networks. It strikes me that these two conclusions would be a key with which to read the well-known but slightly cryptic passage in the Quaderni in which Gramsci offers a critique of the notion of spontaneity. I won't get into that, but in case you're curious, we can discuss that later. So, end of parenthesis. The confidence in the world-making, or another world-making powers of self-organization characteristic of the late 90s was perhaps inseparable from a teleology inspired by a certain technological determinism. One of the ways in which this manifested itself was the notion that we had arrived at a point in which, I'm paraphrasing Hart and Negri here, in which the organizational principles of maximal efficacy, correspondence to the social organization of labor, and democracy coincided in the network form, leading Hart and Negri to conclude that, I quote, "The distributed network structure provides the model for an absolutely democratic organization that corresponds to the dominant forms of economic and social production and is also the most powerful weapon against the ruling power structures," and probably also going to cure cancer. Yet, as we can see from considering the brain as a network, as well as from several other indications provided by network theory, the absolutely democratic, self-organizing nature of networks does not eliminate, but necessarily supposes, an element of hetero-organization, and therefore also leadership. But what do we understand as leadership in this case? What do we understand as leadership in network terms? So networks shape individual choice by providing the informational and effective context in which decisions are made so that a modulation introduced into the network can produce a significant alteration of the probability that any number of individuals will adopt a practice induced by or compatible with the original modulation. We can in fact say that total absence of leadership would entail networks in which the actions of nodes have absolutely no impact on one another, which is clearly a contradiction in terms. The minimal definition implied here is that leadership involves the initiation of behavior ranging from emotive or intellectual attitudes, gestures, words, etc., to complex collaborative actions that will be adopted or adapted by others. The polyvocality of Gramsci's terminology, or of Latin languages in general, actually, because this happens in all Latin languages, is very appropriate. Leaders, in Italian, dirigenti, direzione, are at the most elementary level those who indicate a direction for collective action and are only secondarily directors recognized by others. To lead ultimately means no more than to be followed. At this level of generality, it's evidently hard to distinguish between those instances in which initiation already involves a series of complex collaborative actions, such as setting up an anti-foreclosure campaign, here's your cue for later, and simpler individual ones, such as creating a meme. Yet conceiving of collective action in network terms as a process of diffusion forces us, I think, to see the difference between those things as one in degree rather than in nature. Leadership phenomena stretch along a continuum that goes from punctual incidents in which information or affects rooted by a node produce changes in the behaviors of others to targeted, increasingly purposeful efforts at producing that same effect, followed by the progressive stabilization of influentials or leaders, which can be groups, individuals, web pages, etc., all the way up to the formalization of decision-making mechanisms and leadership structures. So these things are all, you know, from creating a meme to ultimately a party structure, these are all things along a continuum. While it is possible to identify some relevant breaks along the way, the most important being formalization itself, i.e. the formalization of decision-making mechanisms, at no point on that continuum is there a passage from no leadership to leadership. For as long as there is collective action, some element or degree of leadership is involved. Two clarifications are in order at this point. The first one is that although it is possible to influence the behavior of others, even inadvertently by routing information, more precise and elaborate effects depend on the work of carefully honing a message, building alliances, setting up basic infrastructure, creating strategically targeted channels and platforms, producing and circulating material, etc., etc. The more complex a task, the more its success is likely to depend on preparatory work, and hence also a backbone of committed activists. As movements go from largely consensual oppositional targets to situations in which the positive, determinate content to be given to that opposition comes into question, the need for more complex work, and thus also for more purposeful and consistent organizing cores, tends to grow. In other words, the more organic organization of the kind offered in the past by mass organization has neither disappeared nor been rendered superfluous. Like most other things in the world, it has been downsized. Second, this is, I think, easily deducted from the definition of leadership that I've provided, but it bears spelling out just the same. The point about the ubiquity of leadership phenomena can in no way be confused with an appeal to the necessity of strong leaders, a particular kind of authority or organizational structure, or anything of the kind. It's important here that we distinguish between leadership as function as position, and as event. As function, leadership is ubiquitous, a necessary operator of collective action. A position of leadership, on the other hand, is the stabilization, formal or informal, of an exercise of that function. So it's becoming recognized as leader or as direzione. It's therefore closer to the end of the spectrum that corresponds to greater stability and formalization. Leadership as event, on the other hand, is what happens when, in the absence of any precedents or procedures, a group or even individual focuses collective action, attention and action in a certain direction. It's the exercise of function in the absence of position, and therefore logically and chronologically anterior to the stabilization or formalization of leadership or any organizational arrangements. This is what I've previously called vanguard function, which I've summarized in the phrase, it leads only to the extent that it is followed. So leadership as event occupies the opposite far end of the spectrum. It's like the absolute condition, so to speak, for the stabilization of positions of leadership. So to conclude, I'd like to lay out very briefly what I think are the main consequences that I believe can be drawn from this. Number one is that the degree zero of democracy, so to speak, is not procedural, but extra-procedural. It's the possibility of the emergence, in the absence of any agreed procedures to that end, of an initiative that will be adopted by others. As a consequence, number two, this more fundamental level of democracy is not to be thought according to the model of the General Assembly, the consensus meeting, or any such formal arrangements, but as a situation in which, in the absence of any universally accepted formal arrangements, the potential is greatest for leadership to emerge from anywhere. Such a situation would evidently be one in which authority, the monopoly of force, etc., are not concentrated on any single point, but are more or less dispersed. The less institutionalized and concentrated power is, the more a society or group is open to the unexpected novelty of new directions, up to a certain point. Up to a certain point, meaning that beyond a certain point, too much dispersion would hinder communication and thus hinder the emergence of new directions of collective action. So power must be dispersed, but it cannot be totally dispersed. The opposite of concentrated leadership is thus not the absence of leadership, but a condition in which, less encumbered by formal or informal constraints, the leadership function would be freer to circulate. And this is what I've been calling distributed leadership. A further, more general corollary, number four, is that there is no ultimate ideal democratic form. Democracy is a matter of balance of forces before it is a matter of form, so that no form, not even networks, is exempt from the potential onset of vertical or authoritarian tendencies if the forces that kept them in check diminish. From this, it follows, number five, my numbering is out of whack here. Anyway, you work out which number it is. Number five, maybe. That democracy depends to some extent on the inhibition of stabilization and institutionalization. As long as no full-blown centers emerge, the leadership function can circulate more freely. This actually chimes in quite interesting with a point that Massimiliano Tomba was making yesterday on the first Soviet constitution, for those of you who were there. So as long as no full-blown centers emerge, the leadership function can circulate more freely. It's important for distributed leadership to sustain itself that emergent leaders never shake off some of that, I quote, fragility of a power ceaselessly contested, to borrow Pierre Clastres' remark, on Amerindian chieftainship. Yet some degree of stabilization and institutionalization is a more or less inevitable side effect of a continuous exercise of leadership, and to some degree necessary if more complex tasks are to be attempted. So this entails, fifth or sixth, that leadership in general presents us with problems that can be grasped as trade-offs. Trade-offs such as this one, where greater capacity to act entails greater risks of institutionalization, et cetera, et cetera. So we can take, for example, the question of accountability. The smaller organizing corps are, the less they are subject to formal accountability. They have neither the permanent membership nor the statutes to hold them accountable. This, however, is precisely what makes them more dependent, to quote Clastres again, on the goodwill of potential followers. Since they have few members to enforce their decisions, they are permanently dependent on winning supporters over. This means that in principle they are more effectively kept in check by their potential constituency. If they are not followed, they do not lead. So weak formal accountability, in other words, is compensated by strong diffuse accountability. Staying small also means, in theory, more internal accountability and avoiding the dangers of scaling up as an organization. Not having the imperative to recruit allows one to grow selectively, keeping internal relations relatively informal, inhibiting authoritarian tendencies, and minimizing the risk of crippling internal dissensus. Yet this comes at the cost of several executive limitations, so again this has to be balanced against one's objectives, and so on and so forth. In short, to say that leadership, like all organizational problems, presents us with a series of trade-offs is to say that instead of a moral issue to be posed in terms of right or wrong, it invites us to ask questions in terms of how much and how little in the face of each situation. Each situation poses a new problem in a new context, which is why, even though it is a matter of how much, there is no absolute golden mean or perfect equilibrium in questions of leadership or organization. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to try and tie all this together.
Good luck.
Based on the notes that I took during the presentations, I've of course been trying to prepare a little bit, but I've been shocked about what it means to have a 4-month-old baby, and what it means to put a jet lag of 6 hours on top of that. So I hope I will stay awake during my presentation. So I'm going to start with Jason before I go to Rodrigo's presentation, and try to move from a concept of negative solidarity to a concept of positive solidarity, and think through what Rodrigo is talking about as leadership as a problem of producing positive solidarity. So I think the way I understand Jason, he has a strong focus on negative solidarity as an expression of the competitive, let's say, the resentments that arises from a competitive situation between workers who are relatively atomized. So you have a situation of social decomposition, individualization, etc. But still, he's using the concept negative solidarity. So the word solidarity is in there. It's not just competition. So I want to try to understand why the term solidarity applies. So which is, I can pose it as a question, and then I can try my own answer. Which is, what is it that's common, or maybe to use Jason's concept, trans-individual, in this condition of negative solidarity? One thing that is a common experience and pressure is the increasing experience of a zero-sum game. So low growth, low profit rates, less space to redistribute wealth in the form of welfare, but also in the sense of declining wages, etc. So that's one thing that's common in this situation. There is an extreme pressure, not just on individuals, but also on companies.
if we're speaking about low profit rates, which means that we can understand negative solidarity as a solidarity with the struggling companies. Why should these people have so good conditions? Not just because I have bad conditions, but because we know it's bad for the economy. The growth of the economy is a condition for the rest, for all of us having a wage, right? So there's also a lacking imagination of alternatives at play, of course, and a sense of a kind of responsibilization for the common, which is something we, I mean, it's a fucked up, very fucked up common, but it's something that's worth thinking about how that can be turned, the balance of this can be inverted. Another negative solidarity is the state that is under pressure, economically speaking, has less space to redistribute wealth, and is in competition with other states with and the workforce of one country in competition with the workforces of other countries, produces a sense that we're all in this together. A slogan that's been very common in the UK, where I've been living for some years. So this idea we all have to tighten our belts, the logic of austerity. So this is negative solidarity as a solidarity with the state as a common condition for economic well-being. So everyone must carry their part of the burden. So there is something beyond the atomization and the individualism and the competition and this concept of negative solidarity. There is a kind of concern for the economy as a whole, or the national economy as a whole, as well as for the state. I don't know if we can build anything on this, if we want to, but I think it's worth raising the issue. So this condition also entails a different conception of time. So from the solidarity of the classical workers' movement was based on a certain kind of optimism, of certain projection that employment would keep growing, for instance, that growth rates would remain high, etc., that technological development would be benevolent to the conditions of most people. And of course, already Benjamin a long time ago said this was what corrupted the working class. But it was at the same time a condition of a certain concept of solidarity, the one that I've just talked about as a negative solidarity, was expressed as the positive reformist solidarity of the classical workers' movement and welfare state. I've grown up in Denmark. There was plenty of space for migrants because, well, you know, we're all getting richer all the time. The workers' movement is getting stronger. Who cares, right? And what happens now is with the exhaustion of this expansive movement and this optimism, there's also a reconceptualization of space, like the reaffirmation of borders. The nativism, welfare chauvinism, etc. So it's no longer, when the pie is no longer expanding, you don't want to share it with people. There's a certain post-colonial reckoning that I might mention as an aside here, because clearly what the narrative I'm talking about is limited to the countries that were really involved in the boom years of the post-war era. It's not a logic that's globally generalizable, and it was dependent on cheap natures like raw materials, etc., coming to Europe and the States, as well as Western domination of other markets who were relatively uncompetitive. So that's trying to outline some of the questions of negative solidarity and to connect it to what Rodrigo was saying. I think in all this there's a sense of democracy being ossified as a form rather than as a relation of forces. When you have an expanding economy, the class compromise is a plus-sum game. the class struggle becomes something relatively manageable. And you have a kind of, let's say, fetishization of the institutions that secure the redistribution of wealth. So you have like the form of democracy becoming much more important than effective democracy in the way that you're talking about it as a relationship between forces. So then the question is, how do I connect this to Rodrigo's presentation? So one way we could talk about what Rodrigo said was to think of leadership as an answer to the question of what are the conditions of the emergence of a movement and of a movement of solidarity. I mean, as an aside, a question: how do you distinguish within your framework between fascist movements and non-fascist movement? Fascist movement is, of course, not in the strict sense of fascist movements with authoritarian leadership, but micro-fascist movements of like spontaneous street pogroms or whatever. But yeah, anyways, what are the conditions of the emergence of a movement of solidarity? Leadership, Rodrigo says, which I completely agree with. But I think the answer is maybe there's something more to it. Obviously, we would agree with this. One thing is what the question of, not in the Leibnizian sense, but what is the composability of the people in the network, of the groups in the network?
Not in the Leibnizian sense?
Sorry,
it is a Leibnizian question.
It is, but that's a longer discussion, but I think he sees everything from the perspective of God and, you know, what can exist in the world.
Okay,
side
Atardian.
Side. Yeah.
Atardian.
Yeah, exactly. So, what is it that allows people to compose in networks? And I think one thing that we have to get to here is the kind of... it used to be the construction of shared interests, the transformation of mutual competition of workers into shared interest through levers that would make that interest real rather than just abstract, which means the strike, for instance, and a whole range of different tactics would make the abstract notion that people share the same interest because capital is squeezing the wages of everyone into an effective, real collective interest. So there, I would say, we've seen some of the limits of that the classical workers' movement runs into under changing economic conditions that I was mentioning, the tendency to produce a kind of negative solidarity with the state, with the market, or with capital, rather. So I think here I would introduce the problematic of social reproduction as the question of, you know, in the feminist sense, how do people reproduce themselves and each other relationally? And one answer to the problem of reproduction, of course, is to get a job. But that's one answer among many. Another is to marry someone who has an income, to steal a hustle or whatever. There's a whole range of different approaches there. And all those ways of dealing with that is a way to deal with the condition that you can't reproduce yourself, that you don't have the means of reproduction. You don't control them. You have to do something to reproduce yourself. And there I would say race, yeah, take as a starting point what for thinking about leadership is, leadership has to respond to the problem of reproduction in the sense that this is what allows in a way that can change the perception of the problem of reproduction from an idea of a condition that is a condition to a problem, which means you imagine a solution. So leadership entails the development of tactics or the sharing of tactics or the utilization of a tactic in a new situation in a way that responds yeah, that transforms a condition into a problem and starts to work on the problem, launching at least the prospect, if not the actuality of solutions. So I'm interested in where we could go with this idea of leadership as a kind of, if leadership is to be followed, leading could be to have a certain problem solving, to take a problem solving function in relation to these issues. And I don't know how much time have I.
You still have 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, so I'm going to round up with an example because Rodrigo was telling me to speak about the anti-eviction movement.
I cued you.
Yeah, you did. So I think a very good example of this is the housing movement in Spain, La Paz, which I guess many of you are familiar with, but I'm still going to go through it in a way that connects as much as possible to what we've been talking about now. So in Spain, there was a massive housing bubble, mass evictions, more than 500,000 evictions, which means each eviction could be, you know, most evictions would be a family. So a huge number of people. But these were people who were ordinary middle class, low middle class, working class people. In Spain, home ownership is very widespread. So it's also working class people who got sub mortgage lending, who were trying to live the Spanish dream of home ownership, which is a condition that's very individualizing, of course. And as George, for instance, has written about a lot about debt. We know that there is an issue of going from the individualization and shame that's connected to debt to collective action. The way they did that in Spain, the PA, was to say, not to say, oh, we all share the same condition, fuck the banks. They said, we're going to have a meeting for people affected by mortgages. Right? This is, people were... Quite a few people were committing suicide, and most of the people who were facing eviction had some level of depression, etc. So, okay, you go to a place. Rodrigo has a good spiel about this, how that relates to the AA model. But God, go to a place of mutual support. That's a starting point, mutual support. So you see you're not alone. You see other people have been mistreated by the banks. You see that you see the possibility of starting to deal with this collectively. But to go into action is something that most people who come from a life of not engaging actively in politics, it's a very big step to engage in action. So the first thing they did was to make a sticker that people could go to the bank, just put there in the dark or whenever they said, this bank defaults people. And that was the first act of... working with the individualization of people, the fact that they only at that point they had the anger that was developing through these meetings, especially the transformation of anger into shame into anger, and expressing that in individual gestures, but in a way that other people who would go past the ATMs would see that others had put the sticker there, and from there was a development of there was a clamor for the development of tactics to do something to deal with these evictions, which then turned into outright resistance, where basically the bailiff would be turned away, etc. Occupations of banks to force banks into renegotiating mortgages, mortgage conditions, etc., etc. So I think that's a very good example of leadership that has this kind of problem-solving capacity and which traveled all of Spain. There are more than 200 nodes in the network of the PA. And the reason that was possible was not through centralized organization, but through developing a package of tactics that people could adopt and adapt in their situations. So there is also something about leadership not as... as an individual or a group, but leadership in the sense of like a tactic as a partial object around which people a network can organize itself. I'm gonna end there.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org. a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.